Hello everyone, I'm Harry Bucknell. Thank you for downloading this podcast from ABF, the Soldiers' Charity. Last week, ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, marked the 30th anniversary of the First Gulf War with a special programme about operations in the desert. While yesterday, on Friday the 5th of March, our thoughts turned closer to home as we invited our many friends to join us for Friday Night In. A chance to give the telly a well-deserved rest for an evening with a difference. A night of online auctions, prize draws, competitions and a host of special guest interviews with, among others, Claire Balding and former Chief of the General Staff, Lord Dennard. All to help ABF for Soldiers Charity continue its central purpose of supporting our soldiers, veterans and their families in their moment of need. In this edition of General Talk, hear News at One presenter Sam McCoy on Friday Night In as he interviews the BBC's World Affairs editor John Simpson, who talks candidly about his lifetime in journalism, reporting from over 120 countries, 30 war zones, and interviewing 200 world leaders. I hope you enjoy the programme.
John Simpson, it's a great pleasure to talk to you. I have to admit, this is one of the most daunting interviews any journalist can do, because when everyone thinks of any moment in history, you've been there. And I'm to prepare for an interview like this is quite something. And I'm just wondering what process you go through before you do interviews with world leaders, sometimes at moments of pivotal historical importance. I mean, what preparation do you do?
Well, I do quite a lot of preparation, obviously, in terms of, the questions, the areas and so on that I'm going to talk about. And I work out counters for when they throw the question back at me. I mean, that's really quite important. But funnily enough, I think it's a little bit like, you know, the old thing that the actors do, so as not to dry up. They think of the audience as being stark naked. And that gives them a sort of strength, a sort of superiority. And believe
did you
me,
think that with Yasser Arafat? You thought of him sitting there naked, did you?
Oh, well, no, that would have been deeply distasteful, of course. But Yasser Arafat was an easy softie. I'm really thinking about, you know, the toughies of the world, Margaret Thatcher, Saddam Hussein, those kind of people, those kind of people that you can't say, which is often the case, actually. I can't think of the next question. Just hang on in there a moment. I don't think I've ever actually said that to anybody, but you often feel, I remember thinking, particularly with Thatcher, because she had those kind of laser eyes that went right through you. God, I can't think what I'm going to ask next. It doesn't matter, because you always do ask the right thing. But one of the real answers to your question, the main answer, is you have to establish a kind of position for yourself. I don't mean necessarily dominance, because that wouldn't be a very good thing, but you've got to say to yourself, I have every right to be asking this question of this person, and I'm bloody certain I'm going to get a decent answer out of you. It's something about yourself as much as it is about them.
And I wonder who you interviewed who afterwards either they'd surprised you or perhaps disappointed you, and whether they were the rogues, as we perhaps would describe them, that you've interviewed, who you thought, actually, you're very impressive. What do you come away impression-wise from interviews like that?
To be absolutely honest, I'm a little bit, I think, impression-protected. I don't want to be impressed by somebody particularly, because, again, that means that you're one stage down from them, looking up at them. You're a greater person than I expected you to be, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's pretty obvious, I suppose, really, that the best, the kindest, the most intelligent and thoughtful person that I've ever interviewed was Nelson Mandela. who was quite tough. I mean, he certainly wasn't a softie. He didn't roll over and confess or admit things that he didn't mean to. But he had a kind of gentleness of spirit, which meant that he also looked at you as though you were on the same level as him. And a lot of political leaders don't do that. I mean, it's part of their stock in trade to say, I dominate everybody, therefore I dominate you. And the trick is not to be dominated.
And what was that, your proudest moment, Nelson Mandela?
If I say no, that means I'm saying I've had a lot of proud moments. Pride isn't the thing, really. I interviewed Nelson Mandela, got to know him quite well several times. And so it wasn't, this wasn't just a kind of one-off. The thing that, the kind of people that I came to like were ones that I hadn't expected to like beforehand, and saw something kind of interesting and valuable in them.
Now, of course, as well as interviewing the people of history, you've been at the events in history, and I just wonder which one for you was the moment you felt most alone. Whether you felt you were fully supported. Was it Iraq? When was that moment?
I suppose it was Iraq, really, yes. Alone, I'm not sure about, because, you know, the wonderful thing about television, as you know, is that you've always got a cameraman and sometimes a producer with you. And if you're lucky, they'll be really good friends and close friends. And you can talk through your fears and so on. But in terms of loneliness, yes, suppose 1991, the first Gulf War, when we knew that the Americans, British, everybody else were going to throw everything at Baghdad, and I was in Baghdad. And we were getting the kind of weapons that we use, the cruise missiles and the deep penetration bombs and the smart bombs and so on, had never been used in anger before. So we didn't know what these things would do. And the people who were inclined to kind of leave, don't want to sound as though I'm anti-American, because I'm not, but American journalists were first in when it was safe and first out when it ceased to be safe any longer. There were one or two that stayed behind, marvelous people, but mostly they left. And because they knew they shouldn't leave, they tried to persuade those of us who were determined to stay that it was going to be so horrific, so dangerous, that we were throwing our lives away. And I remember one bloke saying to me, putting his arm around me and saying, you know, these bombs, they'll shake your brain to jelly. They'll all your fillings will come out. You'll die the most terrible death. You've got to get out of here. And I just thought, I'm kind of quite attached to my fillings now. I don't want them to go away. And that was a very nerve-wracking moment. The hours before the first Gulf War began in earnest. But, you know, directly it starts, you're too busy. I mean, everybody knows that. You're too busy to worry about it. But it's just the run-up that's always nerve-wracking.
Then, of course, in 2003 in Iraq, you became part of the story, perhaps not something you wanted to be, because you were injured.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't like any part of it, especially didn't like being injured, but I didn't like the way that it sort of got around in the papers and things. But what happened was that we were out on our own. I don't really like being a kind of embedded journalist with armies all around you, because you can't really say what you want to say necessarily. And so we were on our own with nobody, not following any particular army, went out into the into no man's land and got involved in a terrible mess up by the US, actually the US Navy Air Force, which behaved absolutely appallingly and stupidly and dropped a 1,000-pound bomb right on me, my colleagues, and the Kurdish and American special forces we were with. And, it was unpleasant. And, I burst an eardrum and I've still got various large bits of shrapnel in me. And 19, I think, 18 maybe people died, most of them burned to death, which was really horrible. But, nobody forced me to get there.
I want to pick up on the element of being embedded with the military, because I was in Iraq at the same time. Mm. I was in a lift with Terry Lloyd the day before he was to meet his end, because they decided to go ahead and do their own thing. The military provided, when you're embedded, they provide the protection, obviously. But is that at the expense of journalism, do you think?
Well, I tell you what, Simon, I think my experience is, and I have been embedded various times, the longer you stay with a group of people, the more you start to see it from their viewpoint, the more you start to like them, the more you start to want them to succeed. And I find the danger is, and it was very, very true of the invasion of Iraq, the danger is that if they do something they shouldn't, then you've got real problems. I mean, of course, your job is to say, I saw them shooting civilians. And that's happened to me loads of times, particularly with the American forces. These are the very people who are responsible for your safety, for your transport, for feeding you. There's a clash there, which is unpleasant. So always in these kind of big occasions, I've always tried to get away from one side or the other and just be out there with my team in the middle, which is, of course, not always the most sensible or safe place to be. But then Terry Lloyd was with you and he just drove down a road and the Americans shot him and his cameraman as they came back. So there's no guarantee. I mean, somebody said the other day, and I thought, yes, that's exactly what I think. It was a soldier, in fact, who said, when you go to a war, you've got to convince yourself, you've got to tell yourself right from the start, this is it. I'm not coming back from this. So I've just got to do my utmost while I'm able to. And I think that's true of journalists too. You've got to say to yourself, I'm a goner here, so I'm just going to do my very, very best.
Do you think that the days of the John Simpsons of the BBC are closing, given that the technology has changed the way you and I do our business, given that even the irony of a plethora of more channels, it seems to be much harder to get proper journalism on these days, or am I sounding just a bit bitter?
No, I don't think you are. I mean, I wouldn't say proper journalism, because we've seen with our own outfit, and there's lots of other good things done by other outfits, but you know how the BBC Bureau in Beijing, for instance, has done magnificent things in exposing the way the Chinese treat the Uyghurs in the northwest of China. There's a lot of good journalism still being done, but what we've lost, and what I feel terribly sad about, we've lost that business that used to happen right up until about only about 15 years ago, when you could just sort of get on a plane and go somewhere and find the stories and dig them out and come back when you felt that the stories were over and not before. And what we have now is, I mean, every single news organization on the planet is short of cash. And there isn't the money to do that kind of thing. It's not, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's, you know, it's the way the BBC is managed, or it's the influence of this, that, or the other. Actually, it's really because nobody can afford to do the kind of wandering, sort of investigative stuff that we used to do. And I, of course, miss it terribly, but what can you do? You've got to keep on peddling, haven't you?
Well, and the same perhaps could be said for the military. They've had similar problems over the years. You've seen both institutions, if you like, over an amazing period of time. How would you assess the change in the military in that time?
Well, I'm a great fan of the way the British Army has developed over the years that I've watched it. I was the BBC correspondent in Northern Ireland at the time of, for instance, Bloody Sunday in 1972, and I'd watched them from 1969 onwards in Northern Ireland, and the army often didn't behave terribly well. I mean, it behaved probably as well as could be expected under those circumstances, but there were times when you really shuddered. And the army's got it together in a way that, yes, I think other organisations like journalism has had to get it together. It's realised that it's got to run its affairs within the tram lines that are provided for it. I'll give you one little example, which I always feel quite good about. I mean, when you're with the British Army in Afghanistan, say, or in Iraq, they still have to account for every bullet that they fire. And that's terribly important because they know that they've got to use their bullets fairly wisely because they've got to account for them afterwards. And I must sound as though I'm constantly going on about the Americans, but the Americans don't have those kind of restrictions behind them. They don't have the shortages of money, not so much. They are short of money, but not like the British Army is. And they don't have that the kind of oversight over their shoulders. So it's been enough. I mean, for instance, I saw this all through that dreadful war that followed the invasion of Iraq in 2003. I was still reporting on it in 2016. If you're an American soldier, you've only got to say, I thought my life was in danger, and that's why I shot these civilians, for everybody to say, okay, son, stand down, you know, that's we've all been through that. And that isn't the case with British soldiers, and rightly so.
One other thing that journalists on the front line share with the military on the front line is the questions back home before they go there, saying, why do you do it? Why do you put yourself in harm's way?
Well, I mean, there's a number of, there's honest answer, which is I'm a chancer. I'm one of those people that, you know, believes against all the odds that I'm going to get this story and I'm going to get out. But I can't really see the point of doing what the kind of things that I want to do, and then not kind of going through it. And God knows it's hard. Believe me, I mean, Simon, only you and I, of all the people watching this, will understand what an old wet mother hen the BBC is, how difficult it is to break loose of its wings. You know, they want to be reassured about everything all the time. And I just feel, you know, you've got to fight the BBC long before you actually get to the place where the real fighting or the real trouble's going on. Why do I do it? Well, listen, I'm now 77. I mean, I'm not fit to do anything else. I don't want to do anything else. And I enjoy it. And there are times, of course, when I'm absolutely scared, witless, shall I say. It's made up for by the fascination of the whole business.
I think I've read that you've visited 140 countries, you've spoken to 200 world leaders, you've won every award that's going. What's left for John Simpson? Is it a holiday? Is there a country on earth that you've not visited that you'd want to? I mean, what do you want to do?
There are quite a few countries that I'd love to go to. Tibet, as a journalist, and without a little army of interpreters and ministry people following me. I think at this moment, the place that I would love to go back to, been banned from since 2009, one of the finest, loveliest countries on earth, is Iran. Every time there's a sort of change of government in Iran, every time they have an election and a new president gets elected, I write to them. I tend to know I've known all the various candidates until today, and I write to them and say, wouldn't you like a nice can I come and do a good interview with you and all this kind of stuff, can't I come and report on your beautiful country? And of course, you know, the bum's rush is the answer. But I'll go back there one day, and maybe I'll be able to range around a bit there.
John Simpson, it's a great pleasure to talk to you on our Friday night in. Thank you.
Thank you.
With thanks to Sam McCoy and John Simpson for supporting the Soldiers Charity's Friday Night In. If you'd like to sign up for future events, or simply make a donation helping to raise vital funds to enable our soldiers, veterans and their families to live a life of dignity for the service they so selflessly give for the freedom and liberty we take for granted, then please visit soldierscharity.org. Where amongst a host of interesting tales and stories, you can click on the Events tab to get involved, or the big red button marked Donate to make a contribution. It is your kindness which enables us to care for those who put their lives on the line so we may enjoy our today, every day. Without your continued, much valued and generous support, we are nothing. So on behalf of us all at ABF, the Soldiers Charity, thank you in advance. With editing by Michael Stiglianu, this podcast has been a Gamekeeper production for ABF, the Soldiers Charity.